Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care.
Harry Nelson and his firm, Nelson Hardiman, have established themselves as some of the leading healthcare attorneys in the United States. Following the passage of the Affordable Care Act, much of their business focused on helping healthcare organizations learn to navigate the new landscape of healthcare in America. However, following the shock election of Donald Trump and the supposed repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act, all of this was thrown into a period of uncertainty. Frustrated with the dissemination of misinformation in the marketplace, Harry and his partners at the firm authored the book, From Obamacare to Trump Care and Why You Should Care. In this episode, we'll explore the book and what is coming next for both consumers and healthcare organizations. As always, thank you so much for listening to Pop Health Podcast. You can find us online at pophealthpodcast.com, on iTunes in the podcast store, or on Stitcher by searching Pop Health Podcast. Also, be sure to tune in next week when we have the first interview with Kyle Hill since Home Hero's shock exit from the home care industry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm joined now by Harry Nelson, founder of Nelson Hardiman, here in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Your office really is amazing. I know that people can't see it. We're up in West Los Angeles. I think the last time that I was here was actually for Aging 2.0, for a panel that I sat on at Aging 2.0 about technology and healthcare. It was very nice of you to host that that group here. Technology and healthcare could be a whole other, I think, podcast by itself. But thank you so much for coming on the show. Really excited to have you. Just a little background. Harry is one of the most renowned healthcare attorneys, at least in the fields that we run in. So it's really an honor to have you here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. And as we always do when we start, can you tell the audience something that people in the industry might not know about you?
Sure. So one of the things that people usually are caught by surprise is that I'm a dual national. I'm a citizen of Brazil as well as the United States. And it was a little bit of a fluke. My parents were Americans living down in Brazil. But as a result of that, it's kind of sparked in me desire to really address the challenges of poverty and healthcare, which are serious in the United States, but on a whole nother level when you go to South America and to Brazil. So that's something that usually catches people by surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been much ado about the challenges that the American healthcare system faces, and we're actually going to get into that a lot with your book. But on the surface, what is a major difference that you notice between, you know, the American healthcare system and the Brazilian? Is it access to care? Is it quality of care? What's one of the main differences?
I would say the level of inequality is even starker when you look in South America and in Brazil than it is here. So in the United States, we have this idea of equality that's not nearly as reflective in the system. So the have-nots there are much worse off than the have-nots here.
Sure.
Although one of the things that concerns me, and we can talk about today, is that I think we're headed on a path towards a widening gap.
Yeah.
But in our system, government programs have really led to just a significant expansion in availability of care to ordinary Americans, like through Medicare, for example, as they age. That's just not part of the Brazilian system.
Right. That is fascinating. And I think that could be a whole nother topic in and of itself as well. But because you are specifically such a well-known healthcare attorney, is that where you started, is in the healthcare field? Did you know you wanted to be a healthcare attorney? How did you get into the legal side of healthcare?
You know, so I grew up in Detroit, suburban Detroit, and in the 80s, I graduated college in 1990. It seems like a long time ago. But, you know, the real pivotal summer for me was summer of 1988. I had the privilege of being an intern for Congressman Sandy Levin from Michigan. And, you know, as a kid from the Midwest coming to Washington, D.C., my mind was just blown by the extent to which our government was this whole series of regulatory agencies. So I was definitely interested in healthcare. I remember reading and writing letters to constituents on Medicare and following the Medicare donut hole, which was a big reimbursement issue back in the late 80s.
Yeah.
But I came away from that summer really excited about the regulatory state and wanting to go to law school, and I took every regulatory class my school offered. I didn't focus exclusively on healthcare. I was interested in it, but I had a little, you know, after law school I clerked for a judge out in Hawaii, and my co-clerk at the time, who's now the head of compliance at Amgen, she was ahead of me. She sort of was like, she knew we were both interested in regulation, but she was really focused on healthcare. And I listened to her, but she was going back to Washington, D.C. And then back in the early 90s, that was the only place where you saw big law firms with, you know, significant healthcare practices.
Yeah.
I was a Midwesterner. I wanted to go back to Chicago. So I settled on a firm that focused in university law and had a lot of healthcare work for some of the big Chicago area teaching hospitals. So I knew that I was going to get a little bit of healthcare work, but it wasn't until I came out to LA 15 years ago, like 7-8 years in my career, that I really sort of decided just healthcare, and I gave up the whole university thing.
Yeah. So when you clerked for the representative from Hawaii, did you get to do actual work in Hawaii, or was it all in D.C.?
No, those were two different things. When I was in college, I was interning for a congressman from Michigan. But after law school, my first job was serving as a law clerk for a judge, for a federal judge, Harold Fong. It was the best job I ever had.
You know, yeah.
We got off of work at 4 o'clock. We could go boogie boarding. I wasn't much of a surfer, but no, it was great. It was really, that was also, I actually think in retrospect, that played a part of my, I learned, one of the things that I saw in Hawaii was some of the issues of fraud and abuse. I had a chance to work on some False Claims Act cases,
yeah,
that were, that definitely became a point of interest. And I saw a lot of the drug traffic and worked on a lot of federal drug cases, because Hawaii is such a gateway to.
Right, right.
So that became another sort of focal point for me.
A little bit warmer there than Detroit, Chicago, D.C.
Yeah.
So not a bad place to end up. Well, actually, that's a great segue. You talked a little bit about False Claims Act, and you and I had talked a little bit off the mic, but you've got your practice here in Los Angeles. First of all, do you focus mostly in the California area, or does that just kind of how it centralizes, or do you have kind of a wide swath?
I mean,
we
have clients nationally, and even we have some international clients, but I would say 80% of our work is in the state of California. We consider ourselves a regional firm. Like, even though we need to know how to do work everywhere, we our focus is here.
Yeah. Well, in California, will certainly keep you busy. We talked about a few things that are some of the hot topics that are keeping your firm busy right now. Can you go through some of those for the audience?
Sure. Yeah. So one of the things that's just we're straining to keep up with these days is defending False Claims Act cases. The issue of whistleblowers bringing cases to the government's attention against hospitals, health systems, pharmacies, labs has become a massive part of our practice. Probably half of our practice these days is devoted to defending those kind of cases. So that's something that keeps us going. You know, one of the things that's really been a huge area for us the last couple of years has been behavioral health, mm-hmm, meaning addiction and mental health, and the way that the ACA expanded dramatically the opportunities. There was enormous growth, and we're dealing with a lot of the confusion and the problems that have crept up around that industry. There's some other little niches. We're doing a lot of work these days on stem cell and other biologic products that have FDA issues that are getting regulated more intensely. And then this whole area of direct care, of people looking for models where they sort of use retail models to bypass insurance. That's also helping people do that within the law has become a big part of our practice.
Oh, interesting. So is that like direct practice providers, like physicians that are looking? Because we've actually had some guests on the podcast who are doing more of true private practice, you know, for physicians. Is that kind of the space that is?
Or so it definitely started with physicians, and certainly the home care space is part of that. And we've seen it expand into physical therapy and chiropractic and really a growing array of services that are trying to just find a sweet spot where consumers will reach into their wallets without going to the insurance card and find value.
Especially with the rapid pace of technology expansion right now. I know that's a very hot topic. One thing, you'd mentioned the False Claims Act. So just for the people who might not know, specifically with whistleblowers, so when you're talking about defending False Claims Act, is that specifically defending against sometimes unfounded reporting by, say, whistleblowers? How do you work within that space?
Well, I mean, what normally happens is a whistleblower is usually an employee. It could be a patient or it could be a consultant. Mm-hmm. But somebody says, hey, wait a second, there's something really wrong happening in this hospital or this pharmacy, and they bring that to a lawyer. There's a whole wave of lawyers that really didn't exist 20 years ago who are called QUI, Q-U-I. It stands for a Latin phrase that says, who comes for the king? And the idea in the medieval world was that if you took up the king's rights in England, you would get a bounty for the king for asserting his rights. And so what would happen is whistleblowers would go to a lawyer, and the lawyer would prepare a complaint. And the way it works is the lawyer then files that complaint under seal, so it's secret, gives it to the government. And in the federal case, the Department of Justice looks at the case and either says, we want to intervene and we want to pursue this case, or we're going to leave it. What happens is if the government takes the case, the whistleblower gets 10% as a reward after the government settles. On the other hand, if a plaintiff lawyer takes the case and the government stays out and they win, then they get a third of the settlement. What's happened is part of the Affordable Care Act really opened the doors a little bit, and the government's tried to encourage these kind of cases. And in my opinion, they've succeeded a little too much.
Yeah.
One of the big challenges out there for companies is you can turn around and get sued and get a whistleblower suit. And they're serious cases that take many years to resolve.
Right.
I mean, they're good for law firms, but they're bad for healthcare, in my opinion.
And especially when there's an influx of them, it makes maybe finding the ones that have an actual issue or maybe weeding them out. One thing you mentioned with the Affordable Care Act, you know, just kind of shifting to population health ideas that you work on. One thing that we hear a lot, especially with hospitals, you know, they're at risk for so much more now. We keep hearing the word narrowing of networks. Oftentimes that is also tied into some sort of belief that narrowing networks can somehow go against, like, you know, you hear like the Stark laws. But in a lot of senses, it's making sense for hospitals and health systems to narrow their networks because they are so much more at risk for the quality that happens. So how has the narrowing of networks affected your firm?
So I would distinguish between two kinds of narrowing. You were talking about hospitals and health systems narrowing. But before you get there, the long-term trend has been insurance, the health plans, the insurance companies narrowing. And that's been going on for a long time. There's been this cat and mouse game over out-of-network billing, right? And the insurance companies have been trying to figure out how to cut down on all of these non-contracted providers by narrowing their networks. In a way, it's been going on. You ask how it's affected us. Throughout my career since I came to California 15 years ago, we've been watching small health providers, you know, the small and medium-sized physician practices, the solo health professionals, struggle to have any existence, have a financially viable existence outside of contracted relationship. And it's been a small number that have done okay outside of the networks, but that's becoming a harder and harder place to be. So the insurance companies, I think, are slowly, you know, winning this battle, and they're successful in the sense that they're reducing their own costs,
right,
and they're reducing employer costs, I suppose, along the way by narrowing the networks. The problem is it really reduces patient choice. So, you know, it's just a business reality today. I think that anybody in the provider world needs to have a clear strategy and make sure that they have a viable existence if they're looking at out of network, or really alternatively figure out what their strategy is.
Yeah.
So that's different than the second case where a hospital or health system is driving a narrowing. That's about something else, right? It's also revenue driven. I mean, what we're seeing is that over time, it's a harder and harder business and margins are going down. And so hospitals and health systems are needing to find new revenue sources. We have a problem in this country that, you know, one of the reasons we wrote the book, from Obamacare to Trump Care book, was the bottom line is the fundamental problem is that we spend way too much for too little in this country. We spend $8,200 per man, woman, and child in the United States, almost double what some European developed countries spend, and we get very little for it. So what's happened is that part of the government's answer to how to reduce healthcare costs has been to say to hospitals, we're not going to pay for all that inpatient time. So hospitals used to run like hotels, and their job was, as long as we keep two-thirds of our beds full, keep the hospital full with lots of services being run, diagnostic tests being run, doctors consulting on patients, then we're good. And the government basically has put an end to that model. And so the question is, where do hospitals and health systems actually find a financially viable future with a suppression of their utilization? And the answer is they have to move to all these other services, which means they need to control the flow of their patients towards post-acute, towards home health, and so on. And so that's the narrowing happening there, it's just a different facet of the same problem.
Sure. So I guess on both sides, do you see that part of that narrowing is just because you had mentioned that it's so much harder to be independent nowadays? Do you think that a big part of that is because, you know, in the first sense, the insurance companies are being so successful in getting so much bigger and doing that, and so people are having to band together or increase their influence? Is that a big part of why it's a lot harder to be independent?
Look, I think we've reached a point where, you know, we can't keep spending and healthcare costs can't keep rising the way they have for so long. And so, you know, as the financial realities are sort of hitting, they keep putting pressure on downstream. So, yeah, I think that it was inevitable that we were going to get to a point where the government was going to put pressure on the health plans, and then the health plans were going to put pressure on providers.
Yeah.
And we were going to see everybody struggling with lower margins and less profits. I would say there was a golden age of healthcare from the standpoint of providers from the mid-60s, when all of a sudden you had this flowing of government money from Medicare and secondarily from Medicaid. And then it led to a really, in retrospect, if you look back 20 to 30 years throughout the 80s, 90s, a period when a lot of people made a lot of money.
Right.
And then what I saw, you know, particularly when I first came to California in 2002, was that I was talking to a lot of folks who couldn't understand why they weren't making money the way they used to. So I'd routinely have primary care doctors come into my office and they'd say, I don't understand it. I was, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I was making $500,000 and I could take off Wednesdays and play golf. and these days I'm struggling. I'm making $200,000, which that may sound like a lot to some people listening, but when the doctors would take account of their staffing costs and their EHR,
right,
all their office costs, it turned out that for a lot of these people, it wasn't worth being in solo practice.
Right.
So that's kind of what happened, is that whole financial tightening, the money going out of the system, started at the top with the insurance companies, but it trickled down and made a certain kind of solo small practice non-viable. And so I think it's only going to intensify in an era where, you know, you have to have a certain scale to be profitable. You have to find some way to have incredible efficiencies.
Right.
And certainly scale helps. A lot of companies that are at a size now where they're profitable are going to turn around in a few years and find themselves break even. Folks who are already break even now are already in trouble.
Right.
And, you know, probably looking for some kind of an exit, just because the writing's on the wall about what's happening with reimbursement.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of the ways that we have actually had experience together in the past is working on private label partnerships for certain organizations. You mentioned additional revenue streams, and there's a lot of creativity, I think, maybe happening right now with the Affordable Care Act with different revenue streams. So do you see that the clinical providers, or do you work with clinical providers who are looking to add on those different revenue streams? Maybe it's private duty home care, or bringing on, say, what was a private home health and bring it under the umbrella. Do you see that a lot?
Sure. Yeah, we're seeing a huge movement in that direction nationally. So, you talk about home care. And so home care is a fascinating example, but we're seeing it across all services with skilled nursing and with home health agencies. So to talk about this a little bit in a little more depth, when it comes to like referring to home health agencies, hospitals are under their conditions of participation in Medicare, they're required to give patients choices.
Right.
So the challenge is that as part of the Affordable Care Act, hospitals are bearing significant more financial risk if the spend just continues on and on, right? The Medicare is studying the Medicare spending per beneficiary per day, and they're basically holding hospitals accountable in a whole bunch of different mechanisms, whether you talk about bundled payment or ACOs. And under all these mechanisms, hospitals are more at risk. So hospitals don't just want to send a patient to any home health agency that doctor or a discharge planner may want them to go to. They want to make sure they're sending to one that's going to be efficient and deliver care efficiently. And so that's a more complicated. Hospitals looking for new revenue streams have been very excited about private duty home care. You know, what we've seen, and 24 Hour is a good example of this, has been really an innovator in this model of taking a service that's not federally reimbursed and outside of insurance and putting it into the hospital revenue stream through these white label partnerships.
Yeah.
I think it's a smart move both for home care. It's a smart move for hospitals. The big challenge is sort of getting people used to a new model that people aren't familiar with. And the other big challenge is getting patients and their families, their adult children of elderly patients, for example, acquainted with, used to a new environment in which there's going to be a lot more financial responsibility on the family and on the patient to bear some of the costs that might have in the past been borne by Medicare.
Absolutely. I think another thing that we see too is you had mentioned the restrictions on, say, the skilled nursing providers or home health providers who are getting money from, you know, Medicare or Medicaid, that there has to be certain choice there. But I think there's a lot of a gray area on some of the privately paid options as well, or I guess gray area just being different interpretations in a lot of different places as far as home care or assisted living. Do you come across questions about that at all? If, you know, if they do say private label or they do have their own home care or an assisted living that they trust or work with, are they allowed to steer people towards that?
So this is a really confusing area. So when the government came out with these different Affordable Care Act initiatives for value-based care, like the ACO models, the Accountable Care Organizations, and bundled payment, the government specifically gave people exemptions from some of the laws that keep us busy. The Stark rules and the anti-kickback statute, and all these rules that basically limit the ability of hospitals and doctors to drive patients to particular sources. So for the hospitals and the health systems that were participating in ACOs and getting these government exemptions, this was not a gray area. The problem was for everybody else who was trying to figure out if they could discharge and direct where their discharges were going. We give a lot of advice. It's a complicated territory, but in a nutshell, if you can demonstrate to the government that you're doing it for the right reasons, and that you're doing it based on quality of care and on efficiencies and doing it for the benefit of patients as opposed to just for profits, then I think there's room to do it. And we've been giving a lot of advice on this issue around the country and finding that more and more hospitals and health systems are seeing it as a vital function. And we're finding that, you know, patients don't want to be given a phone book full of options.
Right.
Patients actually appreciate being told by people that they trust, whether it's doctors or nurses, discharge planners, this is the best option.
Yeah.
It's hard. There's a problem of transparency of knowing where the best places are. And as long as it's being done for virtuous reasons, we think this is an area where there's room for hospitals and health systems to act appropriately and proactively.
And this all kind of plays into the main reason I was really excited to have you on. You recently authored a book. Congratulations. You know, there's been a lot of change with the healthcare system or a lot of uncertainty. So you authored the book From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care. First of all, you're obviously an expert in this field. Was it more just putting your knowledge down on paper, or was there a really intensive research and kind of development phase for the book?
You know, we wrote this book pretty quickly. I mean, candidly, we wrote the book in 3.5 weeks.
Right.
It's interesting. For the last 7 years, while the Affordable Care Act has been unfolding, I've personally had some frustration over the dialogue. And my feeling has been that, you know, inevitably, like many things, discussion gets oversimplified in the public sphere, and that people, we're not really talking about the real problems. We start talking about these caricatures, right? There's a demonization of positions. And I wasn't somebody who thought the Affordable Care Act was the perfect solution. I certainly wasn't somebody who thought it was a terrible thing. You know, I came down in the middle. And, you know, our feeling after the election was that there was just, I was receiving calls from people and emails suggesting that a lot of people were feeling a lot of anxiety, and there was just an enormous amount of confusion from people as patients about how their individual insurance was going to be affected, from our clients about what was going to happen to their reimbursement, was it going to go away? And so it became very clear within the couple weeks after the election that there was a hole to be filled, and we decided we were in a good position to fill it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like we just sat down and had everything in the book top of mind. But there are a lot of themes in the book that tie into, you know, things that we've been thinking about for a long time.
Right.
The book sort of starts with what's broken in U.S. healthcare, and that's something we've been thinking about for a long time.
Yeah.
And we then kind of go through looking at history. I think one of the things is that we don't really spend a lot of time looking at where the Affordable Care Act came from. In the 45 years that went between this 1965 adoption of Medicare and Medicaid to the 2010 Affordable Care Act enactment, there's a lot of important lessons from that whole era, right? Frankly, President Obama and his administration and congressional Democrats really were looking at the failed example of the Clintons in the 90s, and even further looking back to the debates of the 70s around healthcare. And I think that very few people know those stories.
Yeah.
I mean, very few people know that we came close to having single payer in this country in the early 70s. When Senator Ted Kennedy was promoting a public option because Medicaid didn't cover able-bodied working age people. And we thought that that was important that people know that history. And our goal was to offer a really hard-headed, neutral as possible analysis of where the Affordable Care Act succeeded, where it failed. you know, where the Republicans were likely to offer a promising alternative, where they have problems with what they're offering,
right.
You know, where there was a gap between maybe the Republicans, Paul Ryan and Trump. And just to, we wanted to give people some reason to be hopeful. We didn't want to be falsely optimistic, but we also I feel strongly that, you know, healthcare is complicated and we need constructive dialogue.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like there was any constructive dialogue playing out. And I'm not we were trying hard not to point fingers and say that's the fault of this party or that party. Yeah. But rather, we wanted to issue a call to arms and say to the healthcare community and to say to patients, let's get serious and let's talk about the real issues. And let's acknowledge that Obamacare was a start, but it had problems. Fundamentally, it didn't fix pricing in healthcare. Healthcare is still unaffordable for most Americans, but it did some good, right? It gave us, for 20, 30 million Americans, it at least gave them something. It wasn't perfect. And I was out signing books at LA Times Festival of Books yesterday at USC, and I got people lining up to tell me about why how it was broken.
Yeah.
And I think that's valid. And I actually think that, and likewise, I think a lot of people, particularly here in California, a lot of people are very quick to condemn Paul Ryan's approach and the Republican bill. And I think we should actually take time to really understand it, because I think it's a serious approach. It's grounded in economics. The problem is that we just dismiss the other side.
Right.
And our hope is that the book will contribute to making people smarter about healthcare and hopefully more effective in advocating for whether it's as providers or as patients.
Yeah, I've read the book. It is really great. And especially for people who are interested in the healthcare system or involved, I guess I should say. It was a nice place that everything that you can find in a lot of different places when you're doing your own research was put into one place. And it looks at it from all of the different angles too. And we'll actually get into some of that. Just again, for people, if they're curious, it's called From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care. And it really does lay out the whole backstory. And have you ever written a book before?
No, you know, it's funny. I tried a couple times, but this was really the first time we got through.
Yeah.
We felt pressure because we knew that in January, repeal and replace was going to be front and center. And,
right.
And we thought there was a moment where people would be paying attention.
Yeah.
And we wanted to seize that moment. So it was my first book.
Yeah. And what's the feedback been?
It's been unbelievably good. You know, we've gotten a lot of positive feedback from the provider community. The most exciting thing to us was that there was a particular senator who got really loved the book and bought copies for literally every senator. We had somebody on the House side on a staff role who also liked it, not quite every congressman. But the exciting thing for us has been having people in serious policy positions really appreciate the book. And,
yeah,
you know, we're just glad to be part of the dialogue and hope that we can contribute in some way to advancing it.
And I think that speaks to your efforts to make it a factual book and really just lay everything out on the table, because this is obviously not only one of the hottest topics around just between people on the street, but also one of the most partisan topics. So to write a book about it that really just lays everything out, you did very well. I certainly appreciated that. One interesting thing that was in the book, you know, Medicaid expansion continues to dominate headlines everywhere, especially with the new options that are coming out or potentially coming out. You know, we've heard a lot of buzzwords regarding Medicaid and how it would work for different states. We're in California, and so that has been a very dominant headline here because the Medi-Cal program in California is obviously so robust. But one interesting thing that you broke down in the book, and you had some charts in the book, was that the cost to the federal government for Medicaid is actually substantially less than the cost of Medicare to the federal government. And there are a few different things that breaks down on that, but Medicaid obviously gets such a bad rap all the time, whereas Medicare is generally, you know, seen as this good program that helps people as they're aging. But what is the disparity of the cost of the federal government between the two?
So, I mean, the big difference is that Medicare is entirely federally funded.
Right.
So it's 15% of the federal budget and climbing. And Medicaid, on the other hand, is only 7% of the federal budget. And that's a reflection of the fact that Medicaid was set up as a matching program where the rest of the funds come from the states. And it lets all the states do their own thing. So we see, as you mentioned, we see radically different spending. California is a leader. 30% of the population of California, as we sit here, are Medicaid beneficiaries. And then you have states, particularly some of the southern states, that have taken a much more conservative view and have really limited their spending by by shrinking the size of the Medicaid program in those states.
Yeah. I think there was also a mention that you said about when Medicare was first created, people obviously weren't living nearly as long as they are now. The life expectancy was obviously much lower than it is now. And so that's contributed a lot to the rising cost of Medicare, correct?
Yeah. So I personally think this is like such important stuff because it shows the way that the emotional piece behind Medicare and Medicaid really informed policy. So Medicare was enormously popular from the beginning in 1965. When it was introduced under President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Basically, Medicare was going to give care to everybody over the age of 65. That was the original intention. And that was popular. And as you mentioned, it was a time when Americans were only living to age 70. So it right. wasn't a long-term benefit back then. As we're approaching an average lifespan in the United States of 90, we're not quite there, but we're headed that way. It's a very different benefit. But it was enormously popular, which meant federally funded 90% popular support. And that is just in striking contrast with Medicaid.
Right.
Medicaid for the poor was very controversial. And a lot of people were nervous, particularly southern states were nervous that Medicaid was going to be a way to force racial integration of healthcare facilities. There's a deeper point, which I think America still has a moral ambivalence with poverty that's right. unusual to America when you look around the rest of the world.
Right.
There's this idea that somehow being poor and giving a benefit to able-bodied working age poor people may make them not work as hard. And that's frankly, I see that as a sort of something that comes out of America's Calvinist history, right? If you go back and read some of the early Puritan writers yeah. who you read in grade school, and like when I watch my kids do these Thanksgiving plays, and that's the kind of thing that's an idea that's been in America for 250, 300 years, and it's part of our heritage philosophically, but it's not necessarily a good basis for policy. But in any case, that ambivalence about giving care to able-bodied working-age poor people began in 1965. It's still part of the story today. And as a result, the way we designed Medicaid was leave it to the states, force the states to spend their own money, and let the states design the benefit. And as a result, it's not administered consistently. And of course, then the complaint that's come, particularly from conservatives, is that the Medicaid program is full of fraud and abuse. And the answer on the other side from the progressive Democrats like Bernie Sanders is let's just make one big program together, Medicare and Medicaid. Yeah. That was another thing I heard lots of people at the Festival of Books talking about unifying the two programs. So we have like two polar opposite positions right now in this country of
yeah.
people on the left who want to see the two programs combined so that Medicaid is part of Medicare and it's all federally funded, which would give more people coverage but would cost a lot more. And on the right, we have people who want to roll back Medicaid and put more requirements on working age people
right.
To limit spending.
And it's interesting, we're in Southern California, which is one of the most expensive places in the country to live. And so you see how beneficial it's been. Obviously, the expansion of Medi-Cal here has been enormous, and it's been incredibly helpful. This is a little bit of a side note, but it's even little things like I had a friend very recently who randomly had an injury. He was punctured with something in his abdomen, and so he had to go to the hospital and get stitches. And he only recently got health insurance through the expansion of this, and everything was fine with him, but they had to run certain tests to make sure that he didn't have internal bleeding. And the one test itself was $8,000. So his final bill was just under $1,000 thanks to his health plan. But it was just another reminder to me of what it must have been like to not have access to insurance and how one simple little accident like that could have put people into, you know, financial crisis. It really is incredible when you think about it.
So no, it's a huge problem. And I think, I mean, again, one of our hopes is that people will come to see the expansion of access to care, whether it's through expansion of Medicaid or through the insurance exchanges, yeah. as a positive thing.
Yeah.
One of the big lessons for us, you know, is that in looking at how the debate is unfolding, is that the arguments are almost like ships passing in the night. And on one side, the Democrats are arguing about access to care and making care accessible, and the Republicans are arguing about the cost of care and making the argument that by reducing the cost of care and forcing the market effect, that will drive access. And again, it's not a right and wrong argument, but I think that the bottom line is it's problematic when you look at people not being able to get care or not right. being able to get care anywhere other than the emergency room.
Right, exactly. That also highlights something else that I wanted to point out from your book, because you had a really interesting part in here. Again, you really looked at it from all the different sides. And there was a really interesting study that you highlighted in your book. And it said that in efforts to close the healthcare gap, only 20% improvement can actually come from better healthcare service and delivery. And the other 80% is basically lifestyle choices or different changes like that. So can you explain for the listeners why delivery can only account for, you know, a fifth of the improvement that we can, and what it means that that 80% really falls onto consumers?
Sure. So if you look at the data, like I said, America spends more than any country in the world by a large measure and gets less. Like, we live shorter lives, we live less healthy lives across all income levels. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people keep thinking it's about efficiency of the system. And there's, as you said, there's a number of studies that say there's room to improve, but it's probably only 20% of the solution. And so like just as an example of what we mean by that is, when you look at the way that healthcare costs in the US really spike, it's really in the middle and late 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, America just has this cost curve that just where we're just spending out of control, and the rest of the world it's pretty flat. And a lot of that is these problems like heart disease, coronary obstructive pulmonary disease, mm-hmm. COPD, congestive heart failure, diabetes. And it's a lot of it is driven by underlying social trends, by obesity, by the level of stress in America, which is something we just don't talk about enough, that our expectations of our workforce, the way we live as Americans, makes people more stressed and makes people sicker. And a lot of that sickness doesn't really show up until you get late in life. You see these problems. Some of it is also bad social habits, right? Smoking. And even though we've had so much success in the last few years with smoking cessation, the reality is lung disease, smoking is at much higher levels in the U.S. than other developed countries, and the rates of lung disease and the cost of care for that are much higher. So a lot of the answer to the problems is providing more social support, and it's not only educating people, but certainly for the poor, the sickest Americans are the poorest Americans, and there is a segment of the population, the poorest Americans. You know, it's an issue of diet, it's an issue of housing.
Right.
And so some of that, ironically, you know, this is an argument that makes social conservatives or Republicans sometimes cringe, but by not paying for those things, you know, our argument is we may actually be spending more. So if you don't give somebody a level of support to help them make better life choices, and they end up in the emergency room with a stroke at age 60 or diabetes, you're basically putting a lot of cost going forward on the chronic care that people will need. And it could be that we could spend a little bit on more social support and save a lot in healthcare costs.
Absolutely. It's interesting. I just recently saw up in Northern California a panel of hospital CEOs from Northern California. And across the board, they mentioned that one of the biggest costs that they are working day in and day out to help to bring down and mitigate is end-of-life care. And I think a lot of it has to do with people aren't getting preventative care, whether by choice or by access. And then, like you said, when these problems hit at the end of life, it just balloons the cost to all of these different institutions there.
So end-of-life care is fascinating, is subject to itself. Yeah. The statistic that blows my mind is that 80% of Americans say that they want to die at home, surrounded by loved ones, getting palliative care, and yet only 20% actually do. Lots of people who are in hospitals, the majority of people who are dying in hospital ICUs, having lots of expensive care rendered to them, don't want to be there.
Right.
And so it's a real challenge of how we talk about this issue. And this is an area it's particularly frustrating, because this is an area where anybody who talks about this issue in an honest way is guaranteed to be demonized. It's become like a third rail of American politics. You know, when President Obama put out a commission that wasn't explicitly talking about death panels, but it was talking about putting some protocols in place that might include end of life, they were denounced as death panels. Yeah. And this is an area where both sides do it to each other. And again, not pointing fingers, but it's an area where we need to have a serious conversation, because we end up spending 7 times the amount in the last year of life that we've spent on every other year.
Right.
And if we're looking for places where America can get to be a more efficient, better healthcare system, this is clearly one of the big opportunities.
Yeah. And shameless plug really quickly, if you're interested in some of this stuff, we did have Judy Thomas, who's the president of the Coalition for Compassionate Care in California, on for an episode. So if you want to hear a little bit more about that, I would encourage you to go back, because she is incredibly smart about all of that. And we dove into some of those topics. One last thing I wanted to ask you about from your book, you really also made a point of talking about the implications of where we go from here, both for patients and for healthcare organizations. you talked about a lot of uncertainty with your own clients and things right now, just about expecting where are things going to go. What do you think are some of the main implications, maybe like a main implication for patients to look at moving forward and main implication for healthcare organizations?
Yeah, so for patients, I think the name of the game is just becoming better at self-advocacy. I think that you can't take things for granted in terms of what your health benefit is going to be. And I think patient, you know, more than ever, it's a time when people need to be proactive in educating themselves and really advocating for the care that they need and recognizing how the system is changing. So for example, for anyone who's listening who is or has an aging parent, right, those expenses of home care and figuring that out, that's something that is today more than ever is going to be your responsibility, and figuring out how to make that happen is something that you need to do. For example, we're expecting that more seniors are going to need to find sort of situations where they can live in proximity and share care providers, just because there's not going to be money, as there might have been in the old days, to pay for comfort care for people who needed to be in a skilled nursing because they were too frail. Those beds are not going to be available.
Right.
So there's a lot of changes coming, and I think you need to, whether you're a parent with a child with developmental disabilities, whether you're an adult child of an aging senior, you have to be a lot more proactive, and you're going to need to be thoughtful today about the needs that you're going to have 10 years from now, based on what's changing. For providers, the system is also changing in profound ways. I think figuring out how to survive in a world with a lot less insured lives is going to be key. We think that figuring out how you're going to participate in these networks, you know, how you're going to be contracted into systems is going to be much, much more important. And I think there are different strategies for different kinds of providers. I think there is a more viable track for people to be going directly to the market with retail options. But I think it's going to be technology driven, and healthcare at scale. So anyway, those are just some of the ideas. There's a lot more in our book.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I would encourage people to read the book. One maybe just closing thought from you before we finish up. Without giving away the farm, what do you tell organizations that are trying to prepare right now for what's coming, with the fact that we don't know so much? We had the push towards value-based care. We had all of these things that were being pushed forward. And right now we're kind of in a holding pattern. It seems as though things are going to change, but what do you tell people as they're looking to move forward?
On the provider side, it's all about low cost, figuring out how to participate with low cost services and to move to services that are still going to be viable, even if people are paying out of pocket. In some ways, the uncertainty may be a good thing in that it's forcing a lot more nimbleness on providers. I think that's probably, if I had one single message, that would be it.
Excellent. Well, again, the book is called From Obamacare to Trump Care and Why You Should Care. Harry Nelson, thank you so much for being on and joining me. Where can people find the book?
The book's on Amazon, in Kindle, and in paperback. So if people like it, we definitely appreciate reviews on Amazon.
Absolutely. And then if they have any other questions, do you have a website yourself or anything that people can check out?
So we have we publish a lot at nelsonhardiman.com. I also publish a blog, a personal blog for things that aren't really law firm related, at harrynelson.com. And yeah, I'm happy to connect with people online. We're pretty active on Twitter and other social media. And I would love to have people reach out if they want to talk more or share ideas.
Excellent. All right. Harry, thanks again so much for joining me. And audience, thank you so much for listening to another episode. We really hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time.
Zach, thanks.